or because I know how much I have to lose if I don't stake hold. I have a great deal to offer, if the price is right. It's you who may not have enough to barter with. She gathers a fall of blood-black hair from her face, twists it into a long tail, then knots it at her nape before disengaging and sliding gracefully from the desk. I can't help but stare at what she left behind. What hot-blooded woman wouldn't? Lore is chained naked to a desk, legs spread, affording me a gloriously intimate view. He's magnificent. A tall, massively muscled Viking with thick blonde hair and not one speck of it on his body. Though his abdomen and thighs are crisscrossed with scars, the rest of his skin is sleek and velvety as the head of his... Stop staring. I drag my gaze away, force it to the princess.
I do not barter with humans. I command.
But you have...
You have something. What is it you have?
I say nothing, reveal nothing. I've learned from the best. I meet and hold her gaze expressionless. Time spins out. Finally, she says,
The unseelie princes, fools that they are, think to rule this world.
She spits on the floor.
We came to enslave this male and use it as our weapon, because the dark princes are immune to our ways. Word reached us it can kill things that are difficult to kill, even our brothers. Fey magic is matriarchal. The light princesses are dead. This world is ours.
I realize if she came for lore to eliminate her competition rather than Danny or me, she must not know about the spear and sword.
This world belongs to us, I say. If you try to take it from us, it will be war. A war you will lose.
Try me. Nude, she begins to pad a slow, predatory circle around me. I turn with her and she laughs.
No, you most certainly do not wish one such as we unseen behind your back.
Nor do you wish me unseen behind yours, I purr. She laughs again, and it's a caress to my ears. She's amped up her death by sex fae heat. I feel it expanding around her, yet it doesn't touch me. When I don't respond, her eyes widen. Her mouth shapes a perfect, lush O of surprise. The sexual energy she's channeling pulses hotter. On the desk, Lore bucks and strains against the chains. I wonder if I could somehow accept the energy she's so generously, foolishly throwing off, while rejecting the sexual component. As I consider it, she pads to a stop in front of me. We're the same height. She leans in as if to kiss me.
Oh, what are you? You delicious thing.
She says and wets her lips.
Not like them. Not like us, yet like us. You smell of...
She trails off and stops in front of me, sniffing deeply, leaning into my neck. I don't move. I feel her snuffling at my throat.
Oh, yes, I like that smell very much, but there is... something... It is most...
She's definitely unaware I have the spear. I wonder if she even knows such weapons exist. She seems oddly out of the loop. She recoils like a cobra, drawing up to her full height, back arched away, eyes narrowing, and hisses.
Oh, you smell of them. We will not go back. It finished with us. It said so. We will never go back.
She vanishes.
About fucking time you got rid of her.
Lore recovers his voice with a snarl. He sounds hoarse from hours of yelling. I stand, blinking at her sudden, unexpected disappearance. She shouldn't have been able to sift out of the club. Then again, she shouldn't have been able to get inside in the first place. Either Riordan's wards aren't working, or she's beyond their compulsion.
I frown, trying to decide what she thinks I smell like that drove her away so completely. There are multiple possibilities. The stain of her brother's rape lingering on my soul. The green goo of the gray woman I butchered. Perhaps she detects the sworn enemy of the Fae, my she-seer sisters on my skin, in my blood. Or maybe the oily residue of the unseelie that stalked me, who, as if summoned by that last thought, swiftly began popping one after another into the room with me, crushing close, giving lore wide berth. Apparently it was the princess they were avoiding. I wish I knew why. I'd make Ode de Unseelie Princess perfume of her flesh and spray myself with it if I thought it might work. She said, them. So obviously it wasn't the singularity of the book she sensed inside me, and that she would not go back. Go back where? And who'd put her there to begin with? On the desk, Laura makes a sound of such raw sexual need that I shiver.
Oh, Mac.
He growls.
I need. Get your ass over here.
Priya is a hellish thing to be. It reduces you to a whimpering, broken, pathetic sex addict that will do anything for anyone at any time. I have memories I've interred deep. Places in my mind I'll never visit again. Whimpering and broken are the key words there. What do you need, Lore? I say dryly.
What the fuck do you think I need? Sex. Constantly. I'll die if I don't have it all the time. I'm Priya.
Priya.
Sure as shit, the bitch made me Priya. You saw her. I had an unseelie princess on top of me. My dick hurts so bad it's gonna explode. I need sex. I can't live without it. This is torture. So either get on it or find me a hot blonde babe that will. Which is any hot blonde babe in the club.
He adds cheerfully. I like Lore. He's aggressive, domineering, and part caveman, but he doesn't have a cruel bone in his body, and he flat out adores women and children. I sometimes think if the other eight weren't around, Lore would be a very different man. Leave it to him to try to capitalize on the princess's visit. Use it as an excuse to spend the next few months in bed, receiving a steady stream of women whose sole purpose is to have sex with him 24/7. I know what Priya looks like, and he's not it. Though part of her magic somehow worked on him, the nine are apparently impossible to turn Priya. I wonder if they're too basely sexual to begin with. Perhaps the charge they throw off cancels out her sexuality, or at least dampens the full effect of it. I decide I'll stick close to Barron's until I figure out how to get rid of her, and if there are others out there. She might not have turned Lore into a permanent slave, but a temporary one is bad enough. Deep in my she-seer center, I activate an antenna of sorts to listen at all times for the gothic dark march of the princess. I move toward the door. Riordan can unchain Lore. I'm not getting close to the man while he's naked. He told me once he prefers a club over a woman's head because charm wastes energy better spent fucking, and I believe him. Although I see no club in the office, there are other heavy objects.
Aw, come on, Mac,
he says, sounding aggrieved.
Would it really kill you to let them think I'm Priya? What have I ever done to you? Tonight was traumatic. Bitch actually made me call her mistress. I need some good old-fashioned fucking to ease my pain. Maybe a sexy, yes, master or two. Or 200. What's wrong with that?
I raise my palm and prepare to press it to the wall.
Seriously, honey, I promise I'll only take a few weeks to get better. I won't drag it out. I'm sitting on the jackpot right now. I'll do something for you. Anything. Name it. Well, not anything, but there's gotta be something you want.
I smile and retract my hand before it touches the panel. 5 minutes later, I open the door and shake my head, tears welling in my eyes. We didn't get to him in time, I tell Riordan. She's gone, but I was too late. She'd already turned him Priya. Send all the blondes you can spare to take him somewhere private. Hurry, and I wouldn't go near him if I were you. It's not pretty. You won't want to remember him this way.
She can turn us prior,
Riordan says. Afraid so. There's a bounce in my step as I rejoin Barons. I got what I wanted tonight, after all. A favor owed from one of the nine is worth its weight in pure fairy dust. And now I finally get to go have sex with Barons. And from the way he's looking at me, it's going to be one seriously long, hot night.
You're going the wrong way,
Riordan says behind us. I glance over my shoulder. What do you mean? We're going back to the bookstore. I did what you asked. I got rid of her.
You just told me she can turn us prior, and our wards don't prevent her from sifting while within the walls of my club. You will remain in residence, guarding against all princesses until we resolve the situation. You'll find ample quarters in that direction.
He points the other way.
Perhaps you'll do what you should have done this time, and kill her next time.
My bounce vanishes. You didn't tell me to kill her.
It was self-evident.
No, it wasn't, I say pissily. I took a page from your negotiating with the princes book, and you sent all the others into Faerie. They're not even here to protect.
I'm still here.
I look up at Barons, who stopped walking and is regarding me intently, eyes narrowed. He looks as if he's about to speak, debates, folds his arms and says nothing. You could stand up for me, I grouse. Tell him we're going back to the store, period. He smiles faintly.
It would hardly be fair if you protected only me.
His light emphasis on the word protected gives him away. No idea how, but he knows I lied. And he's amused. And he's going to sit back and watch it play out. See how stuck I get in the sticky spider web I've begun to spin. Guess he really is sick of my idiotic passivity. So am I. But as I learned today, it's way the hell better than idiotic activity. Confined to Chester's with no escape from my carrion stalkers. Forced to contend with Riordan on a daily basis. Surrounded by monsters. Inhabited by a monster. I'm afraid there's more of it coming. 13. I was ducking down to reload. Jada. She needs to kill. Purpose is strength, and hers was impeded tonight. No matter. When one avenue is blocked, another is revealed. There are two on her list in the direction she's headed. They will be dispatched differently than her prior intended target. Swiftly, with more mercy than they deserve. Though their crimes are many, unlike the Unseelie she seeks, they are human. She eliminates humans quickly. She takes no pleasure in the kill. There is satisfaction in seeing debts collected, ledgers balanced. There are those she will protect at any cost. As she turns a corner and enters a dimly lit street, her gaze lifts to the shattered street lamp, then down to lightly misted cobblestones and back up again. She pauses to absorb the scene. The Unseelie blood dripping from the jagged glass that housed the light, the many pieces of unmoving fey flesh tossed in a heap, the small pile of human parts with wilted flowers placed carefully on top, the footsteps in the scattered debris, trails of blood and smears of green that map out movements. She moves closer. Someone placed the human's picture ID on top of the flowers so he would be found and identified, bestowing the blessing of closure so those who cared might not wonder endlessly if their husband or father might one day walk in the door again. If not for the blossoms, she would think it an act of vengeance, not compassion. A killer followed by a merciful passerby. She closes her eyes, analyzes, assesses, processes all she saw and factors in what she has come to understand about humans and monsters in her years of war. Working methodically, logically, she recreates the events that transpired in this street. She eliminates the possibility of two separate actors. This was the work of one. Someone killed a fae and butchered a human by accident in the process. Someone killed her fae. If she felt, which she doesn't, her emotions would run the gamut from stunned to furious. Neither disrupts her serene features. Someone else adjusted her ledgers. She wants to know who. She steps closer to the pile of Unseelie flesh, notes the suckered fingers, the gray skin. The individual spear wounds in each small piece by which the dismembered yet still alive Unseelie was granted death. From the shape of the wounds, she knows the killer. Her name is also on her list. She covets the weapon. Once she has acquired it, she will be unstoppable. She lifts her head. A fae is moving toward her, rapidly, powerful, Unseelie. She has been hunting this one, but not to kill. "You wish the Unseelie prince is dead," she says to the knight. She knows the knight is always listening. "I will do it for you, but you must do something for me." She finds it necessary to repeat herself three times before the princess with ice-white skin and cobalt hair appears in the damp street before her.
"What makes you think I won't kill you where you stand?"
Imperial ice drips from the princess's words. "Perhaps you could, perhaps you couldn't. Perhaps you could use an ally in this city whose strengths chink your weaknesses. Perhaps we both could. Not that either of us have many weaknesses. Still, there are those few. You and your brother princes are immune to one another, powerless to spell or destroy one another. I deem that a significant weakness."
Starry eyes narrow as the princess takes her measure.
Jada says, "There is the devil that can't get the job done and won't eat you, and the devil that can get the job done but might. We are both the latter. I agree not to eat you."
The princess's eyes narrow and she appears to be reconsidering her initial assessment. "Perhaps we can aid one another, if the price is acceptable.
You will locate a certain Unseelie for me,"
she tells her the one she seeks.
"Even I do not approach that one,"
the princess hisses. "Then I will not kill your brothers."
"It is impossible."
"I said locate, not kill. That is the price. It is non-negotiable."
"How do you think to kill the princess? You are human."
"I know where to obtain a weapon that kills Fae."
"There is no such thing."
"There is."
"All Fae?"
"Yes."
"And you can get this weapon?"
"Yes."
The princess is silent a time, then finally says,
"Perhaps you have useful knowledge. I will not kill you tonight. You will show me this weapon and demonstrate its power.
You will locate the one I seek first. Then you will take me there."
"Locate. That is all."
"Both. Or nothing."
"That would be two services rendered. The weapon becomes mine."
"Two princes for two services," she says flatly.
Ancient cold eyes regard her. She is acutely aware of the precariousness of the moment, but one that fails to venture never gains. Finally, the princess says,
"In times of war, allies are useful.
I will offer my services for your future needs. The weapon will be part of those services."
"I will consider it."
The princess vanishes.
14.
"Fool," said I, "you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows." Cat.
"My gift, if you can call it that, is an empathetic heart. I began crying the moment I was born, and wept until I was 5 years, 3 months and 17 days old. The afternoon Rowena came to my parents' house and began teaching me to shield myself from the constant barrage of others' emotions. I often think I've learned nothing, except how to stop crying. Don a mask and pretend the world isn't too much for me to bear. I know how fragile we are, how biased the war that rages on this planet where the angels are made of glass and the demons of concrete. All you have to do is drop one of us and we shatter.
Last night I watched Sean across the dangerous expanse of a treaty table and realized our love is glass too. I must become diamond dust to strengthen the mix. In the days preceding the Hoarfrost King's defeat, Marjorie enlisted Riordan's aid to tether a dangerous, drifting fragment of fairy that was about to demolish our abbey. And the price Riordan called due from me the night I went to pay our debt was Sean, filling in as a waiter at Chester's for a time. So the dominoes began to fall. Sean can't bear to watch people suffering any more than I, and confronted by those in need, he became their provider. It's a strength I admire with all my heart. Yet it's also the same treacherous foundation upon which both our families were built. Our fathers possessed an enormous sense of responsibility for their own, and their own came to them with problems and requests, each more difficult to address, to satisfy than the last. Over time it corrupted them. The lime of murder, the viscosity of revenge, cemented the blood in their hearts until they too were poured of concrete. I move through the dance floors of Chester's with purpose, my shields as high as I can raise them, yet I cannot block the immense loneliness of this densely crowded place, the hunger and despair, desperation and need. So many angels, so many cracks. They don't even require dropping. A fair jostle would do the trick. I have the care of 271 women in Dublin. The eldest, Tantiana, my wise, gentle, ancient adviser, whose eyes seem to stare straight into heaven, is a month dead, murdered by the Crimson Hag. Christian paid the ultimate price for our freedom that night, and I'm powerless to help save him. One of my younger charges, Danny, enormously gifted and enormously impulsive, has been missing for weeks now, and I fear the worst. Marjorie seethes and plots daily to take the reign I would gratefully relinquish, just not to her. My soulmate has assumed charge of the black market and put himself in direct competition with two unseelie princes and a ruthless male that defies quantifying. Now there are new she-seers in Dublin, led by a woman not even Riordan has been able to track. I've never felt so inept in my life. I want to rebuild my abbey. I want to fill the walls 1,000 strong again. I want the strength of concrete without the price of it. When I came here months ago, seeking Riordan to repay my debt, he said a thing I've been unable to stop thinking about. Drop your blinders and raise the sewer to eye level. Admit you're swimming in shit. If you don't acknowledge the turd hurtling down the drain toward you, you can't dodge it. I've come to get out of the toilet bowl and become the commode that flushes the shit. The fragment of a fairy fire world I prayed was responsible for the grass that grows tall and green beyond my bedroom window, directly above Cruz's icy prison, is gone now. Yet the meadow is more verdant than before, exploding with poppies, red, fat, bobbing, opium-drenched blossoms that drug my senses on warm evenings when the projection of a great, black-winged prince circles my bed. I have warded him out of my tangle of linens with blood magic, an art I'd sworn never to practice, a line I wouldn't cross. But it is no longer only myself I must protect. Elaborate golden trellises have pushed up from the earth all over the abbey's grounds, draped with black roses that reek of exotic spices and far-off lands. Dozens of standing stones have appeared in the gardens, etched with symbols I can't read. A pair of megaliths awaits a cover stone to become a dolmen. It makes me shiver when I pass. Pearl benches frame a vast, brilliant, many-tiered fountain, in which water sparkles as turquoise as a Caribbean sea. Animals I've never seen before peek at me from trees fringed with lacy vines that grow strange beyond our walls, shedding brown bark for ivory threaded with silver, sprouting low-hanging canopies of sapphire leaves. The floors in my section of the abbey are changing from stone to polished gold. At night, I hear male laughter echoing down our halls and corridors. The lights within our walls glow soft gold day and night, without electricity to source them. Our fires blaze without wood to feed them. Our generators run only a small number of lamps. We remove the bulbs. Still, they glow. Something unholy powers the rest. Cruz is changing our home, taking it over, and I know it's only a matter of time before the jailer is evicted by the jailed. Paradise lost. We talk of it amongst ourselves, but so far have said nothing to outsiders. This is our home, for many of us the only good one we've known. If we do not find a way to stop the transformation, we will be forced to leave. Soon. We are not yet ready to admit defeat. If we are driven forth, who will watch the Abbey? We will sit idly beyond its walls, praying the prisoner never breaks free. I cradle my belly with one hand protectively. I've not yet begun to show. I devote most of my energy to shielding it. I must secure our future. When I reach the bottom of the glass stairs in the glass house that the concrete demon Raiden calls home, he is waiting for me. But of course. Why did you lie about Sean? I ask him.
I didn't lie. You sewed my words into a cloth of your choosing. If you'll recall, I urged you to talk to him that night. Had you heeded my advice, you would have known, soulmates and all, confiding everything.
Don't mock me.
Don't make it so easy.
You said you were collecting my debt from him.
I said I was willing to accept the replacement of a missing server as full payment and let you off the hook.
And put me on another.
You chose to become the worm. A little conversation goes a long way, Katerina. You've still not told Sean that Cruz fucks you in your dreams.
I'll say nothing, and he laughs.
Yet here you are, seeking me again. Come for more answers to which you won't listen. I only waste my breath once. Leave.
I'll remain where I am. He sweeps me with that cool silver gaze and arches a brow.
Be very certain you know what you're doing, Katerina.
He warns softly.
If you ask something of me, I will not stop until I feel the request has been satisfied, as I deem fit.
A fix on two words, he uttered. You do not feel.
It's you, my ever-serene cat, that fails to feel. Denying at your own peril the hunger of your heart.
Nor do you know anything of the heart, mine or any other's.
State your cause, I have pressing matters to attend.
I stare up into the face of the man that does not exist, that according to my empathic senses is not even standing there, and choose my words with care. I can proceed with nothing less than 100% commitment to my course, and am fully aware this path will make or break me. I wish I could predict which one it will be, but I'm untested, unproven. I resist the urge to cradle my abdomen. I must not telegraph in front of this man. I must become something else. He has a bold hand and a sharp chisel. The clay has chosen the sculptor. This male, whatever he is, possesses power beyond my humble skills. He and his men know what I do not, how to protect what is theirs. They are ruthless and hard, and successful. If I think to care for my charges, for my child, I must learn to be similarly successful. I've come to acknowledge the turd. He smiles.
It's about time, Katerina.
I suffered my father's disappointment mere days after I was born, although at the time I didn't know it for what it was, only that I was rejected and alone. As the years passed, his anger and disgust at the useless daughter he couldn't barter away to further cement his position grew so oppressive, I learned to avoid him whenever possible. My mother's greed and impatience, shallowness and fear were my childhood companions. Then there was Sean, with whom I grew, who loved me, uncomplicated from the first, even as I wept. Still, it's often difficult to bear the nuances of his every emotion. Filet mignon or ribeye, we're all imperfect cuts, marbled by fears and insecurities, even the best of men. As we move deeper into Chester's, the barrage of chaotic emotions begins to subside, affording me a rare and blessed respite. The volume of the world's endless sensations has been reduced from a 10 to a 4. We navigate one glass corridor after the next, and I wonder that he leads me so deep into his club where others are not permitted. After a time, he glides his palm over a smooth glass wall, and an elevator appears. "Where are you taking me?" I ask as the elevator door closes, sealing me in a much too small compartment with a much too large man. I feel like Dante, descending into the inferno. But I have no Roman poet as my guide.
From this moment on, any questions are mine. Assuming you wish to be concrete without the price.
I stare up at him. How can he possibly know that? You can read minds.
Human thoughts are loud. We take what's offered. Humans offer too much of everything.
What are you going to do? Teach me to fight? I glance down at my slender arms. Though strong from gardening, milking, and working our land, I doubt I possess the ability to hurt another human being. I would feel their pain. I don't invite that.
Not me.
He escorts me from the elevator into the most blissfully silent corridor I've ever walked. I turn in a slow circle, listening, but hearing nothing. This level must be powerfully soundproofed. There's no faint beat of music, not even white noise, only the perfect absence of sound. Who then? He guides me down the hall with a hand at the small of my back, opens another door, and we step into a dimly lit, long room with faintly illuminated rectangles that lead to additional rooms beyond. There are no furnishings here. No table, sofa, rug, or chair. The floors are polished ebony. The walls are ivory. A diffuse glow emanates from the perimeter of high, coffered ceilings, with stamped leather insets above Romanesque cove mouldings. There are large corbels on two of the walls, as if once treasures were displayed. The room is refined. The occupant is not. A man is stretched on the floor, staring up, arms crossed behind his head. Like the rest of Riordan's men, he is tall, wide, powerfully muscled, scarred, and not there. He wears black camouflage pants low at his hips, feet bare. His arms are tattooed, his head nearly shaved, his face shadowed dark with stubble. He looks like a rogue military commander from a unit the world never hears about.
Castillo will be your instructor.
I stare at him in disbelief. Joe has told me tales of the Nine, though they've been of little use. Castillo is the one that does not speak. According to Joe, something transpired a long time ago, and he hasn't uttered a word since. Is this your idea of a joke? He doesn't talk.
You don't listen, match made in heaven.
Riordan stalks over to Castillo and looks down at him.
Castillo will be your instructor,
he says again. But this time it's an order, and a warning to the man on the floor.
The woman feels the pain of the world. You'll teach her to stop feeling it. Then you will help her learn to control her environment. Finally, you will teach her to fight.
Castillo, of course, says nothing. I'm not certain he even heard. He appears in a trance, elsewhere. Riordan walks to the door.
You'll remain with him until I decide you've gotten what you came for.
The door closes behind him, and I stand there a moment, staring blankly at it, then at Castillo. I rush to the door and place my palm to the wall where Riordan pressed it, but nothing happens. A hammer on the door. Riordan, I must return to the Abbey. Riordan, let me out! The only response is the most enormous silence I've ever heard. This is not what I meant. I hammer until my fists are bruised. Riordan, you can't do this. My charges need me. There are things you don't know. I came here to tell you. I feel as if I'm in the bowels of the earth, forgotten. I shout until my throat burns. The man on the floor never stirs. I'm unable to count the passage of time in this silent, empty place. After a length of it, I sink to the floor and lean back against the wall, one hand resting lightly on my belly. Surely he'll feed me. Surely there is a bathroom here somewhere. Surely he'll come back so I can convey to him the urgent state of our abbey. I sit and stare like the unmoving, unblinking man on the floor. After a time, I become aware of the simplicity of the moment. Not only is there no sound on this level, there seems to be a dearth of emotion. Cautiously, I lower the shields I've held since I was 5 years old, barriers that have shut out the world and walled me in. Nothing. Again, I lower. Lower. When I continue to encounter nothing, I take a deep breath, brace myself and drop them flat. I gasp. Still, nothing. I feel no anger or greed, no lust or fear or pain or need. That's always the worst for me, the many crushing, painful needs that can never be satisfied. Here, deep below Chester's, there is absolutely no emotion charging the air, compressing me, forcing me into a defensive posture. It's sublime. My heart can breathe. For the first time in my life, I feel only me. I didn't even know what I felt like. For the first time in my life, I can hear myself think. 15. I'm just a crack in this castle of glass. Mac. I hear music in my dreams. I heard such exquisite melodies during my teens that one day I decided I was fated to be a brilliant composer, put songs to paper, and share them with the world. I joined the band that very day. I even signed up for extra classes and asked Mom and Dad to hire a tutor to help me learn to read and write sheet music. I plunged into the world of an aspiring musician with enormous enthusiasm, certain of my predestined success. In less than a month, my tutor stalked out of our house and refused to come back, and the high school band director asked me to please do the entire band a favor. Quit. I have no musical talent. My clarinet sounded like an apoplectic yak. For the brief days I blew the trumpet, a hostile-sounding pig snorted along in jerky fits and starts with the rest of the irritated band. I never knew when a sound was actually going to come out of the horn, and it always startled me when it did. My violin unleashed a trio of enraged, tone-deaf banshees, and I couldn't blow the flute well enough to make any more sound than with my lower lip on a soda bottle. Something about the pucker eluded me. The drums turned my arms into a pretzel prison from which there was no escape. I would have given the tambourine a try. I really think I might have excelled at the hip bump, but sadly, the instrument wasn't offered at my school. I think that's why I love my iPod so much. I have music in my soul and can't get it out. This morning, like the two before it, the melody of my subconscious has been different. 3 mornings in a row, I've awakened with the strains of a symphony fading from my mind that is beyond horrific. Last night was the worst yet, as if I'm becoming attuned to it, hearing it louder, feeling it more intensely. My psyche is bruised, my spine hot, and my stomach cramped. The new song is unlike any of the others I've heard in my dreams. It doesn't leave me glowing, feeling uplifted and free. Nor do I see dreamy, fantastic images while it plays. I can use none of my usual vocabulary to describe it. I lie in bed with my head under the covers, trying to figure out what was so disturbing about the melody that I woke with pillows clenched to my ears, arms aching from the strain of having held them there half the night. I search for words. Scary? No, worse. Depressing? No, worse. Capable of making me insane if I had to listen to it too long? Worse. Is there worse than insane? I roll over and poke my head from beneath the mound of pillows and blankets. I'm alone in bed, which I often am, at least while I'm sleeping, since Barron's doesn't require it. However, I am not alone in the room. Without the wards on the bookstore to keep them at bay, Barron said it would take weeks to collect more of the necessary ingredients. My grim stalkers huddle close, pressed to three sides of the bed. On the fourth, roosting atop the headboard, bony shoulders hunched upward, swallowing their heads and necks. Two crouch on the bed right next to me. My pajamas have cobwebs on them. I've been sleeping in PJs, not about to risk being unconscious, nude, around any unseelie. Needless to say, sex hasn't been happening here. Although, when Barron's is touching me, or even just next to me, I enjoy the same wide berth they grant him. I don't get off on being an exhibitionist, at least not to unseelie. Not only am I bitchy, bored, and too powerful for my own good, I don't get to vent on Barron's big, hard body, and I'm massively overdue for it. I'm beginning to think it's all some part of the universe's conspiracy to see just what it takes to make Michaela Lane snap. Like a wake of vultures, every last one of them is facing me, peering down. Well, inasmuch as they might face me, peering down, considering I've never seen beneath those voluminous hoods, and can't even say whether they have faces or eyes. I used to think they were clothed. They're not. The dusty, cobwebbed, cowled cloaks they wear have the texture of black chicken skin and are part of them. Riordan said they were the cast that once attended the king in his private chambers. Do they stalk me, not because the book within me deliberately summoned them, but because, like Kavruk, they sense me as part of the king they once served? If so, when the king takes the book out of me, they should vanish too. At the moment, they're mute. Not a chitter, not a rustle. I find their silence nearly as disturbing as the dark symphony of my dreams. Had it gotten so loud they could hear it in my head? Did it button the lips of even my loquacious tormentors? I wonder if, like the vultures they resemble, they too have highly corrosive stomach acid that makes them capable of digesting putrid carcasses infected with bacteria and parasites dangerous to their species. At least they don't vomit like vultures when threatened, or urinate straight down their legs to cool themselves and kill the bacteria they pick up wading through rotting corpses. Good the fuck morning to me. It's a broody one, as usual. Back up, you bastards, I mutter, swinging my legs over the edge of the bed. They don't. They brush against my pajama bottoms, leaving it covered with cobwebs and yellow dust. I can't get back to BB&B fast enough. At least there I slept in peace, got to have sex, and woke in a room free of vermin. I perch on the edge of the mattress, staring up at my flock. The Shisadu said they were my priests, and that I could command them. I know better than to trust the Shisadu, and I worry that if I issue even one tiny command, such as, "Get the hell away from me, and that's an order," the book will somehow own a piece of my soul. Or maybe if you start ordering this cast around, it antagonizes them so much they eat you. Or perhaps they'll start vomiting and pissing, and then I'll be walking around all the time in upchuck and urine, stinking of three different things instead of a single bad smell. One thing I do know is things can always get worse, most often at the precise moment you've decided they can't. And so I remain, as Barron's would pithily say, idiotically passive. I sigh and begin to dress, thinking I might kill for a Starbucks, heavy on the espresso. I lose sense of time in Chester's. There are no windows, and if you stay there a while, it messes with your circadian rhythm. I think I've been here 3 nights now, listening for the music of an unseelie princess, and trying to figure out how to get past Riordan's wards and explore the many secrets of Chester's. Time and again I've turned around and walked away, rather than call on something inside me to push past a particularly sticky spot, allowing the book no opportunity to goad me.
I lost 2.5 hours in the street that afternoon and have no idea what the book did with me. I don't know if I spent all of it torturing and killing, or...
I terminate that thought. No point in going there. It's done. I can't undo it. I can only never let it happen again. Brooding about it will only make me feel worse, and when I feel my worst is when the Shisadu talks the most.
As I round the perimeter balustrade and approach the top of the stairs, flanked by my gaunt ghouls, I realize it must be early morning, as the club is empty except for the many waiters and waitresses wiping things down. I hope they use antibacterial cleanser, because virtually every horizontal surface gets used as a bed at some point. There are only a few hours when the dance floors are deserted. Riot encloses the doors at dawn and doesn't reopen to the public until 11 a.m. I've heard that's when he gives his infamous nod to some woman and takes her upstairs. I've also heard that for an uncommonly long time, it's been the she-seer, Joe. Really, how much of a relationship can she think they're having when he's still selecting her every morning? As if I've summoned the event merely by thinking of it, I turn the corner to see Riordan standing at the top of the stairs, looking down. Lucky me. I get to witness the nod. Woohoo! Could my morning get any better? I stop abruptly, and bony vultures pile into my back. They're still silent. It creeps me out. I glance down to my right, past the railing. There's Joe, looking up, waiting. I wonder again what the hell he thinks he's doing with her. What she thinks she's doing with him. Anyone can see they're no match. Anyone can predict how this disaster will end. One morning, Riordan will walk to the stairs. He'll look down, and Joe will look up. And Riordan will look beyond her to some other woman and nod. Joe will never share his bed again. Barons and his men are something else. I may not care for Riordan. We have baggage between us, but I have to admit any woman takes one look at him and wonders. And wants. It's visceral. You know that when one of the nine gets down to fucking, your world is about to get rocked like never before. And like it never will again. Unless you become a nine groupie, which I can honestly say might have its merits. If I was Joe and it was Barons at the top of these stairs, what would I do? Like Joe, would I choose to take what I could get of the hottest, dirty, intense sex and passion I'd ever experience and deem it worth a shattered heart? There's no question it will break hers. I see the hunger in her face. I see the light in her eyes as she gazes up at him. I see the tenderness and the desire and need in every line of her body. It's not there in his. He's untouched by her. She burns for him. I want to grab him, shake him, demand he stop before he destroys her. I want to grab her, shake her, demand she stop before she's destroyed. I hold my breath in silence. It's not my place to choose for Joe a path I'm not sure I'd be willing to walk myself. Life is short. At the buffet of it, who doesn't want the best dessert? Riordan nods. Joe's cue to toss her cleaning rag and race up the stairs into his arms. They'll pass me and disappear into his office or a nearby bedroom, and I'll go downstairs and pilfer precious eggs from the nine's private kitchen, whip up an omelet and break into their espresso machine. Maybe even find some milk to add to my coffee. Oh, happy day. Joe holds Riordan's gaze for a long moment. Her lashes drop to shield her eyes. Slowly, she turns her back on him and resumes wiping tables. I gape. Stunned. Nothing against Joe, but I didn't think she had it in her. I want to leap up on the rail and cheer her choice to pull the plug before the bathwater drowns her. Riordan stands unmoving, looking down at Joe's back. I begin to inch backward, feeling suddenly like the voyeur I am, in no mood to be caught at it. Joe turns around and looks up at him. I know what she wants to see. She'll never find it on that implacable face. I want to shout at her to turn away again. Stop mining for gold where there is none.
I tear my gaze from her and glance back at Raiden. Again I gape. That's me, the flapping jaw this morning. I didn't expect this. Not from him.
He drops his head forward in a gesture of sorrow and lets it hang a moment. Then he inclines it slowly in acceptance and respect, and I see the tension in Joe's body ease a little when he acknowledges her as a valued loss. I hold my breath, waiting for the bastard to nod to the next woman. The waitresses are all staring hungrily up, bristling with excitement that the boss's bed is once again open, and their lives just got so much more thrilling. Some other lucky woman is about to get her world rocked and lord it over all the other waitresses until she, too, is rejected. She won't care. It's a status symbol. Like the disgusting unseelie roaches they invite beneath their skin as fat burners. Riordan turns from the railing and is abruptly walking directly for me. There goes my jaw again. I might need to muzzle myself to keep it in place this morning. I search his face, trying to read it.
Don't mind for gold where there is none, Mac.
Stay out of my head.
Wouldn't be so easy to get in there if it wasn't so empty.
Jackass. I scowl at his back as he vanishes down the hall. I'm heading up the stairs after breakfast when Barons opens the door to Riordan's office and inclines his head, motioning me in. I didn't know he was back. I suck in a breath. I wonder if we can evade Riordan's radar and slip off to the bookstore. For heaven's sake, I'd take 15 minutes. Anything would help. Part of his neck is now tattooed, and I wonder what he's been up to while I was sleeping. A good-looking kid stands inside. Tall, lean, and lanky, with thick, dark hair that hasn't been cut in a while, and beautiful aqua eyes behind glasses. I put him at about 18 to 20. He has a sort of brainy Canterbury scholar look, even in jeans and a blue t-shirt. He gives me an appraising once-over as I step inside, then cocks his head as if processing some anomaly.
Tell her what you told us.
Riordan says to the kid, closing the door on my ghoulish procession. I don't tell him it's pointless. He'll figure it out soon enough. The kid says to me,
Who are you? And why do you smell so bad? Don't you have showers in this place? I can hook one up for you.
I have to unclench my jaw to answer. I'm Mac. Who are you? The kid whistles soft and low.
Ah. So you're the one who broke her heart.
I don't ask her who. I don't want to go there. The kid goes there anyway.
Danny calls out your name when she sleeps. A lot. Sometimes Alina.
Riordan seems to suddenly expand and saturate the air like Barron's does.
You won't be hearing it again. Danny sleeps at Chester's now.
I say nothing. Keep my mask on.
She doesn't sleep anywhere lately, old dude. Thought we established that last time you came calling. And the first time. And the 20th time. Kid, you want to be careful around me. Ditto.
The kid says mildly.
Old dude.
You haven't seen her either? I ask hastily, trying to stave off a completely unmatched battle.
Nope.
The kid replies.
But she's disappeared before. Like I told the boss man here. And his lackeys. And his lackeys' lackeys. I hate it when she does this.
I almost smile. He calls Riordan's men lackeys. I'd like him for that alone. Unseelie begins sifting into the office since they can't use the door. The room doesn't hold many, considering how wide a berth they give all three males. Not just Riordan and Barons, who they always steer clear of by 10 feet or more, but also the boy that must be Dancer if he's heard Danny talk in her sleep. I grow more aggravated by the moment as they cozy up to my backside. Dancer? Really? They don't bother a teenage kid? Barons and Riordan are eyeing him too, no doubt wondering the same thing. Dancer shrugs.
Guess they don't like my soap. They certainly like something about you. And dude, do they stink? So what gives with this?
He asks me.
Why do they like you so much? I find that fascinating myself,
Riordan said.
Answer the kid.
Barons gives him a look.
Tell her what you just told us,
he says to Dancer. Dancer pushes his glasses up on his nose, managing to look adorably brainy and hot in a collegiate hunk way. I get what Danny sees in him. He's pretty much perfect for her. If only he had a few superhero parts. Danny is going to be hell on a man's self-esteem when she grows up. And while Dancer doesn't seem to suffer in that department, in this world, caring about a mere human is a liability.
After we defeated the Hoarfrost King, I couldn't let it rest. Something was bothering me. I get obsessive like that when facts don't gel, or do so in a way that seems to imply impending catastrophe. Then I have to...
Riordan says.
Not one fucking ounce of interest in your personal problems. Christ, you're a cranky bloke,
he says to Riordan. To me, he says.
Each of the Unseelie has a favorite food. The Unseelie that was icing Dublin and its inhabitants was devouring a specific frequency.
Okay, that's weird. Why would an Unseelie feed off a sound?
Danny and I speculate it was trying to complete itself. That it was aware it was derived from an imperfect song of making, and was attempting to obtain the correct elements to evolve into something else.
Go on.
I was able to isolate the precise frequency, the flatted or diminished fifth.
I had less than a month of music theory. What's the flatted fifth? Dancer says.
Mi contra fa est diabolus in musica, where the mi and fa don't refer to the third and fourth notes of the musical scale, but to the medieval principle of overlapping hexachords.
I say impatiently, clarify.
Also known as Satan's music, or the devil's tritone. It's an interval spanning three whole tones, such as C up to F sharp, or F sharp up to C, the inverted tritone. It's used in Soyrons, can be found in the hymn A Mighty Fortress is Our God, Metallica's For Whom the Bell Tolls, Purple Haze by Jimi Hendrix, Black Sabbath by Black Sabbath, Wagner's Gotterdammerung, the Dante Sonata by Liszt, Beethoven's...
We get the picture. Get on with it.
Barons growls.
Mathematically speaking, harmonies are created by notes sounding together in proportion to one another that can be expressed in numbers. The devil's tritone is commonly assigned the ratio of 64 to 45, or 45 to 32, depending on the musical contexts. And your eyes are glazing and I haven't even gotten started.
Dancer says.
Okay then. It's jarring, disconcerting, some even consider it depressing. There's a lot of controversy about whether or not ecclesiastical sorts banned it in medieval times out of fear it could summon the devil. Him.
He breaks off and grins at me.
Or herself. How's that for layman speak? Personally, I find it challenging, invigorating.
Again with the we don't give a fuck,
Riordan says.
Tell her what you told us.
The grin fades.
Like music, all matter is composed of frequencies. Where the Hoarfrost King took his bites of melody from the world, it completely consumed that frequency.
What are you saying? We have no flatted fifths left? He gives me a look like I have two heads. Math and physics have never been my strong suits. I guess again. It's quieter in the places he iced? Dancer says.
In a sense, cosmically. And that's only part of the problem.
What's the real-world application? I growl. Nobody likes feeling dumb.
I'm getting there. I had a hunch. I've been going back to the scenes every day. I didn't find what I was looking for until a few days ago, and I've been observing it since, taking measurements, projecting and speculating on the potential ramifications of...
He breaks off and looks at Riordan.
I think we better show her. Telling her doesn't seem to be working. I thought you said she was smart.
I took Baron's word for it.
Apparently, he was misinformed.
Dancer says. I have the beginnings of a headache. Oh, shut up, both of you, and just show me what you're talking about.
I think the church is the closest spot where she can get a good look.
Dancer says.
The one outside Chester's is still forming.
Riordan looks pissed.
I've got one closer.
Whatever it is and wherever, he's not at all happy about it. I follow the three of them to the door of one of the many sleekly concealed elevators in the club. Because there isn't room enough for my vault of vultures to maintain their distance from the men when we step inside, I get a respite. I hear thumps as they settle on the roof of the compartment.
We ride down and down. Through the walls of the elevator, I watch the levels of the club whiz by as we descend into the chrome and glass belly of the beast. Like the city hidden beneath the abbey, the private part of Chester's is enormous. There's no way they built it all recently. I wonder if it's been standing as long as, or longer than, the She-Seer's hallowed enclave. And if so, where they got the building materials back then? We continue dropping for half a mile or more. I can feel tons and tons of earth around and above me and shiver. I've always hated being underground, but my interment in Melusha's lair beneath the burren escalated dislike to near claustrophobia. I can barely breathe down here. As we begin to slow, Riordan says,
"Do not exit until I do. Then follow me, remaining behind me at all times."
The compartment settles and the door swishes open. I move into the dark, silent corridor behind his broad back. The air is chillingly cold. It's so dark that I instinctively open my She-Seer senses to scan for the unique shade frequency, a trick I perfected last month when I discovered a ship down near the docks where several of the vampiric Unseelie had holed up. And instantly, my head explodes with pain. I fall to my knees, clutching my skull with both hands, crying out. I haven't felt pain like this since the night I went to meet Christian at Trinity College. I made it only a few blocks before the Shisadu reduced me to a gibbering, drooling mess in a gutter in Temple Bar, crushed by the agony it was inflicting. Spikes pound through my brain. My stomach cramps and my spine becomes a red-hot poker impaling my body. Pain fills me until I'm nothing but a single, giant, exposed nerve alternately being raked over coals, then diced and iced before getting seared again. Barons has me then, his arms strong, sheltering.
"What the fuck, Mac?"
he growls.
"What's happening?"
We are definitely not having sex, so I must be dying. He called me Mac. "Music," I grit through clenched teeth. "That damned music."
"You hear music down here?"
Dancer sounds incredulous. My only response is a whimper. Distantly, through the pain, I'm aware Barons is carrying me back onto the elevator.
"Get a picture of it,"
Riordan says to Dancer.
"Already got a dozen. Other places? When I tell you to do something, don't think, don't talk, don't breathe. Reality check. Thinking and breathing, necessary to take pictures. Otherwise, I might end up with shots of fucking do it. Your nose hairs, or mine, or you won't have a fucking nose left, you keep talking."
I hear a cell phone camera snapping. Whatever it is, I want to see it for myself. I didn't make the miserable trek below ground and suffer this pain to leave without getting a good look at whatever our latest problem is. I drag my pounding head from Baron's chest and peer into the darkness beyond. Riordan shines the wide beam of a powerful flashlight out the door. My stalkers have begun popping into the corridor. Halfway down the hall, I see a low-hanging round black globe. Not because Riordan's flashlight has illuminated it, but because the beam has lit everything but the circular area suspended in the air. One of the Unseelie sifts in close to it, and as more arrive, it glides back to make room and inadvertently brushes the black globe. The instant it touches it, the ghoul contorts, is stretched long and thin into a tatter of black-skinned robe and bones, and screams with such terror that the skin all over my body prickles in goose flesh. As its hood elongates impossibly, I catch a glimpse of something shiny, metallic where I think its face should be. The black globe swallows it whole, which is impossible, given the globe doesn't have a 20th the mass of the Unseelie. My ghouls jostle and shove in panic. Each one that brushes the globe suffers the same fate, stretched long and thin, then gone. The screaming is deafening, far worse than the hideous chittering. Some sift out, others stand frozen. The elevator doors close.
"Now'd you get it?"
Dancer says. I'd shake my head, but it would explode. I peer at him with pain-blurred eyes and whisper, "No."
When the Hoarfrost King bit chunks of frequency from our world, it created a cosmic deficit. The fabric of our universe began to unravel. That alone was problematic enough, but compounding it, at each site where it fed, it also deposited something, like an overfed scavenger, regurgitating unwanted bones. Whatever it expelled possesses astronomically compact mass and density.
He pauses. When a light bulb doesn't instantly brighten over my head, he says with elaborate patience,
"It's deforming space-time."
"Are you saying what I just saw is a black hole?" I manage. The farther we get from the globe, the less pain I feel. Dancer says,
"I lack the ability to perform the tests I'd like to run. Speculation aside, I can only observe these facts. They share certain similar characteristics to black holes. They were no larger than pinpricks at first. They absorb everything they come in contact with. And they're growing. The one we just saw is the largest I've seen at any of the sites. It's the first place they got iced,"
Riordan says. "You didn't tell me any of this," I mutter crossly to Barons. Barons shoots me a dry look that says, "Far be it from me to disrupt your brood. You might be motivated to do something, and then I wouldn't know who you were anymore." I wrinkle my nose at him and don't dignify it with a response.
"I didn't know you had one in the club,"
Dancer says.
"I thought the one out front would get the honors. Dude, Chester's is going to be swallowed from the inside. Dude me one more time, and you're dead."
We ride the rest of the way up the shaft in silence.
16. The Unseelie King settles into what passes as an enormous red-crushed velvet chair, in what might loosely be called a theater room, before a stage so vast the edges furl out into night skies filled with stars. On the left, the Milky Way shimmers. To the right, a nebula stains the sky rainbow bright. He rests his head of sorts on a hand of sorts and broods. His woman retains no memory of him at all. She knows him only as the Seelie Queen's greatest enemy, and believes that since the Unseelie Prince was unable to kill her, the king himself came to finish the job. Though she conceals it with defiance, she is terrified of him. To see his beloved gaze upon him with fear, there are no words. Neither split into dozens of humans, as he must be in order to walk among the tiny, strange, absurdly determined creatures who face such futile odds, nor as a god. The joy that burned inside him upon seeing her again is ash. He changes a channel of sorts with a remote of sorts, and one of the more interesting cities on one of his more interesting worlds takes the limelight. It is dying, as he suspected. No matter. Another will come. But another of her will not come. In all this time, no one has touched him as she has. To have her back again and not have her at all is almost worse than believing her gone. It is as if a replication has risen from the dead, a perfect mirror image, nothing within. Should he take her into the White Mansion, confront her with the residue of their love?
"Is that Dublin?"
Her voice is beautiful. She had names for him. Endearments, she called him. He would raise worlds to hear them again. She stands behind him, close enough that if she chose she could place a hand on his shoulder, were he not the size of a skyscraper and she the size of a pea. Once, she wore a glamour that met him size for girth, wing for wing, crown for crown. He does not bother to answer. Temple Bar is red, the River Liffey silver. She has eyes. She knows this world.
"Am I prisoner here?"
"You are." He was never letting her go. He would not turn and gaze 50 floors of wing and blackness down at her. He was uncertain what he might do if he did.
"What are you doing to Dublin? It ails, I feel it."
He doesn't want to see that beneath a cloak of ermine fur, she's wearing a diaphanous gown of white that does nothing to conceal her exquisite body, her hair bound in a platinum braid. He would commit genocide on a dozen planets to see her in a gown of blood red, pale hair spilling to her ankles, joy in her eyes, a smile of greeting. I do nothing. They do it themselves.
Attend it,
she says imperiously.
My druids are there.
Give me an incentive.
My druids are there.
That is not one. He doesn't bother to conceal his bitterness. Should he take her beneath him? Discover if that makes her recall, if memory can be forced to return.
You will not coerce intimacy where none is granted,
she says sharply. He goes very still. I did not say that.
You did.
She can still hear him. She may not remember him or the epic love they share, but she hears his desires, as she always has. I would never.
You would. You are the Unsilly King. You slew the one who ruled before me. You care for nothing and never have. You think you create, but you destroy. That is all of which you are capable.
Anger, and something deeper ruffles his wings. Her words are too similar to the note he still carries. That is untrue.
Show me. Help my druids.
God does not step in and adjust minute details on a whim.
You are not God. You are the Unsealy King, once the true queen's consort. You built an army of monstrosities and took them to war against my people. And destroy is precisely what you do.
Once, she helped shelter his monstrosities, believed they deserved the light, that they could be perfected, freed. For you, my love.
I am not your love. I am Avil, Queen of the Fae. Return me to my court. I am needed there.
Return you for what? You can do nothing to repair the rift between your world and theirs. The many rifts in them both. Abandon it, and abandon your foolish, petty court. Choose me, he doesn't say. Not that insignificant world. Not those tiny, inconsequential beings.
To live with a foolish, petty king?
She thinks him a fool and petty. He will not acknowledge the arrow shot as a question. She calls him a destroyer. She sees nothing of his glory, recalls no details of the worlds they once made together. So beautiful, they often rested on a nearby star for time uncounted to watch them bloom.
You say you love me,
she says.
Show me. Restore Dublin. Heal their world and mine.
Why have you always cared so much about these tiny worlds?
Why have you never?
He had once, when she'd cared about him. He'd made himself small for her and walked in her manner, tending small things. But being small was so much more complicated than being God. If I do this for you, will you share my bed of your own volition? He feels her anger, her instant denial. On stage he weaves for her a brutal, horrific glamour of what's to come. Dublin falling, the earth dying, the lovely blue and white planet blinking out, then gone. Attached to it by a planetary umbilical cord, the Fae realm also goes black and disappears. Behind him she gasps, then says stiffly,
That is your price.
That is my price.
And you will fix our worlds?
I will.
And you can?
I can.
One time only,
she says tightly. I specify the duration.
It is limited to a single human fortnight. Then you will never come to me again. You will not seek me. You will never cross my path.
Before?
When it is done, that is non-negotiable.
Everything is negotiable if the correct pressure is applied. The look she gives him is venom and ice. He will concede for her, always only for her. Say it, he demands.
Yes.
She hisses. She said yes. Even spat with fury, the single word is an aria to one's deafened ears. None has ever been sweeter on her lips. He will taste her assent before, like her memory, it too vanishes. Your tithe to this compact between us will be a kiss. He begins reducing himself to make it so. He will turn and touch her, take her in his arms. He doesn't tell her that it's too late. He will have, at the very least, a single kiss. Without the song of making, which she has never known and he turned his back on long ago, none can save either world, fey or human.
17. I'd rather have a bottle in front of me. Mac. I'm an aimless, trapped barfly, stalked by unseelie ghouls who have once again replenished their numbers, confined to Chester's by Riordan's insistence that I guard against a threat that isn't the threat he thinks it is, while driving myself crazy, worrying about a genuine threat of cataclysmic proportions. There's a black hole, or its close approximation, growing beneath my feet, and who knows how many more forming beyond the club's walls. There were numerous icings in Dublin, more outside the city, and according to Riordan, hundreds in various countries around the world. Are innocent people, like the unseelie ghouls, accidentally brushing up against them and dying? How large are the other globes? Was Riordan's really the first, or has the Hoarfrost King been in our realm longer than we know? Perhaps it started in China, or Australia, or even America. How solid is our information? How soon can we send scouts to learn more? How close have I walked to one of those quantum pinpricks, not realizing death was right there in the street with me, a misstep away? Tired of wandering from one dance floor to the next, growing increasingly aggravated by the patrons, I decide to stake out the Sinatra Club. The old world elegance appeals to me, and it's mostly empty. Or at least it was before me and my dark, smelly army arrived. Get off those stools. I try to shoo them. They resettle with what I imagine are scornful looks beneath voluminous hoods. I recall the metallic flash I'd glimpsed as one of them was devoured by an impossibly dense globe of corrupted space-time, and wonder what would happen if I tried to yank back one of their cowls to see a face. I decide against it. I'd rather not know just how hideous my second skins are. I have enough nightmares. I perch on a leather bar stool between them and begin watching an obviously inebriated bartender in a dirty, wrinkled tux that looks like he slept in it make the worst martinis I've ever seen. Clubs call pretty much anything a martini now, and there's no question he got his credentials at the School of Life. He should be ashamed. I rummage in my purse, pop an aspirin in my mouth, and crunch it to dispel headache residue. Barons went through the Silvers to join the rest of the nine hunting for Danny. I prefer him there than wandering around the city without me. Though I've not gotten the faintest tweak from my inner antenna, it won't be long before the princess resurfaces somewhere. And it's not going to be on top of Barons. Dancer says we need Danny now more than ever. She was the one who figured out what the Hoarfrost King was doing, and he hopes their brains combined hold the key to relocking the doors that are opening in great yawning black holes all over our world. If it can even be done. According to physics, what we seek is impossible. But since the walls came down between man and fairy, human laws of physics no longer apply. I wonder if the fragments of fairy worlds I call IFPs are contributing to the black hole problem. The boundaries of our world are a mess and have been for a while, creating a highly unstable environment where pretty much anything could go wrong, as it did eons ago in the ancient Hall of All Days and the Silvers. I wonder that we didn't see something like this coming. I munch an olive to get the taste of aspirin out of my mouth.
Hey, you didn't order a drink. Stay the fuck out of my condiment tray.
The bartender barks, hostile and a little slurry. Whatever happened to pretty girls getting free drinks? Or at least one damn olive?
I peer up at my reflection in the mirror behind the bar. There I am. Blonde hair, blue eyes, terrific white teeth. Thanks, Mom, Dad, and braces. A nice mouth with a generous lower lip, clear skin. I think I'm pretty.
And you guys.
The bartender snaps at my ghouls, and I think, good luck with that.
Order drinks or get off my stools.
You've been grazing on candied cherries for the past 10 minutes, I tell him. You've eaten half a jar, stow it. People are starving in Dublin, but Chester's has condiments. He flips me off with both hands and rotates the birds around each other. I turn sideways on the stool so I don't have to see him and resume my brood. The city I love is finally coming back to life, and although I have personal problems, they are slightly more manageable, or at least a little less urgent at the moment, than our newfound global issues. My dark companion attempts to seize the moment.
Read me. Open me. I possess the answers you seek.
It lies.
I will show you how to heal this world.
Again with the been there, done that. I don't believe the Unseelie King dumped any knowledge about how to patch holes in worlds into his book of dark magic. It's another fake carrot at the end of the Shisadu's endless profusion of sticks. Besides, it wouldn't give a rat's ass about saving this world. It would leave and find another, and another, ad infinitum. I've not forgotten it once said to me,
can there be any act of creation that does not first destroy? Villages fall, cities rise, humans die. Life springs from the soil wherein they lie. Is not any act of destruction, should time enough pass, an act of creation?
Our worries about rebuilding, parceling out districts, and reinstating currency now seem insignificant. But Riordan insists we carry on. Barons agrees that not only must we pursue an illusion of normalcy, but conceal from the general populace the danger the world is in. They contend if people believe the world might be ending, it'll be the riots of Halloween all over again. Oh, yeah, politicians are us. I seriously doubt we're going to be able to hide it long. If they're still too small to spot, it's only a matter of time before they're not. People will start seeing them, messing with them, vanishing. I half expected Barons and Riordan to say, screw it, pack up, we're leaving. They're immortal, and there are countless worlds. There's nothing to stop them from circling their wagons and heading off for the universe's vast, untamed Wild West. Yet they stay, and I'm glad they do, because there's no way I'm giving up on my world. This is what we've been fighting about since the dawn of time, when the Fae first arrived on our planet and began messing with it. Earth is ours. I'm not letting them have it. I'm not letting them destroy it. Not on my watch. Too bad I have no idea how I'm going to back up my ballsy position. But I've been in impossible situations before and got out of them. My brain processes what I just watched happen. Apparently, I couldn't keep my eyes off the pathetic excuse for a bartender and turned back toward him at some point without realizing it. Oh, for heaven's sake, you just ruined that drink. Who taught you to pour?
Fuck you, bitch, ain't you a bar?
I stand and hurry around the counter. My flock rustles in behind me. It is now. Get out, I'm taking over. I can't let him tarnish my profession anymore. He just served a smoked martini that had begun promisingly with gin and a dash of single malt scotch, then apparently forgot what he was doing and added vermouth and, insult to injury, an olive, pimento intact instead of a lemon twist. Yellow was Alina's favorite color, and I used to take my time making my lemon twists as complex and pretty as they could be, little origami fruit peels. My mouth puckers in sympathy for the silver-haired gentleman sipping the drink. It's no wonder the world no longer knows what martinis are.
Who the fuck do you think you are?
The bleary-eyed bartender snarls drunkenly as I approach.
This is my bar. Get your ass back on that stool and buy a drink or leave, you stupid cunt, and get those smelly fucks out of here.
I see red. like I'd drink anything he poured. And I really hate the C word. No clue why, it just doesn't work for me. Seems I have my own event horizon. Inactivity, worry, and frustration have devoured my patience, sucked it away into a deep dark hole from which it may never return. I walk straight for him and pop him in the face with my fist. Not too hard, just hard enough to get him to go away. His nose spurts blood.
Yes, blood, yes.
The book explodes.
Kill him, worthless piece of human trash. Take this bar and take the club and we will kafrock them all.
I rummage for my seventh grade performance. Where did I leave off? I remember being 11. I was happy then, in a much simpler world, or so I thought.
Blood red like the blood of Mick O'Leary, the man you ripped to pieces with your bare hands, then chewed.
For a second, I can't find my place. The word chewed throws me off so badly, and instead of focusing, I wonder if I had blood in my mouth that day and didn't notice. Panicked, I plunge into my recitation at the first place I can think of and shout, "Prophet!" said I, "thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, whether tempter sent or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore." The bartender clutches his nose and stares at me like I have three heads. I toss him the positively filthy bar towel he'd been using to dry clean glasses. Well, as clean as they could be, considering the water in the sink behind the bar is disgustingly black with weak gray soapy suds. I realize I'm still spouting poetry, and terminate mid-12th stanza.
You're off your fucking rocker!
You have no idea. I don't have a rocker anymore. I don't even have a fucking porch to put it on. And there certainly aren't slow-paddling fans or magnolia trees blossoming above aforementioned missing chair. Gotta get homesick for the South sometimes. A sunny day, a polka-dot bikini and a swimming pool. One day I'm going back to Ashford. I'll walk around and pretend I'm a normal person. Just for a day or two. I'll punch you again, so move. I crowd him with my body and force him to walk backward through my throng of unseelie, out from behind the lovely bar I realize I'm really looking forward to tending. It'll feel like old times. Soothe me. Ground me to the real Mac Lane again.
I'm telling the boss, you freaky bitch.
You do that. Tell him the name's Mac when you talk to him and see how well that goes over. Now get out and stay out. I turn to the gentleman who's completely unfazed by our bizarre altercation. This is Chester's, and is currently studying his awful martini as if trying to decide what went so wrong with it, and pluck the glass from his hand. It wasn't even the right glass. Smoked? He nods. Be right up. I pull the drain on the filthy water, rummage beneath the bar for clean towels, wash my hands, grab a chilled glass and stir a perfectly proportioned smoked martini. I'm so used to dealing with my wraiths, I slide smoothly through them. When he tastes it, he smiles appreciatively, and the ground beneath my feet solidifies just like that. Familiar routine is balm to a fragmented soul. I begin rearranging the liquor on my shelves the proper way, humming beneath my breath. Inside me, a book humps closed. For the time being. Looks like I've learned one more way to temporarily shut it up. Poems and bartending. Who'd have thought? But band-aids for my disease aren't what I'm after. I want a surgeon to perform an operation that leaves a deep incision where something nasty used to be, followed by a scar to remind me every day that it's over and I survived. And for that, I need a half-mad king. Not getting any closer to finding the spell stuck in this place. "Hey, Mac," Joe says, dropping onto a stool. "What's with all the unseelie behind your bar?" "Don't ask. Just don't even go there." She shrugs. "Have you seen Danny lately?" That question has become a stake through my heart. One of these days, I'm just going to snap. Yes, and I'm the jackass that chased her into the hall of all days, so crucify me and put me out of my misery. I give my standard non-committal reply. How about Cat? Not for a few days. Beneath a cap of short dark hair, shimmering with blonde and auburn highlights, Joe's delicate face is pale, her eyes red from crying. I shake my head and debate saying something about what I saw this morning. My brain vetoes the idea. My mouth says, I saw what you did this morning. Proving my suspicion that the road between the two is as bad as the highways around Atlanta, under eternal hazardous construction. What do you mean? She says warily. Riordan nodded and you turned away. You dumped him. She inhales sharply and holds it a moment. Then, I suppose you think I'm crazy. No, I say. I think you're beautiful and smart and talented and deserve a man that can feel with something besides his dick. She blinks and looks surprised, and it pisses me off because she should know all of that. I understood from the beginning what he was, Mac, she says tiredly. What it was between us. But he has such... And I never felt... And I started wanting to believe, even though I knew better. Began telling myself all kinds of lies. So I moved on before he did. Pride was all I had left to salvage. Doesn't make it any easier, though, does it? I say sympathetically. I feel my bartending skills blossoming. The pouring, listening, steering away from complete anesthetization with alcohol towards something that might actually help. Change the person's life. Shake it up in a good way. I don't think I'm strong enough to stay away from him, Mac. I'm going to quit working here. I can't see him every day. You know what they're like. He may not have taken anyone else up those stairs this morning, but he will. I'm going to ask Kat if I can move back to the Abbey. Know the best way to forget a man? A frontal lobotomy? I snort, thinking of that song we used to play back home in the brickyard that went, I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy. No, with two men. She smiles, but it fades swiftly. I'm afraid I'd be needing 10 to clear my head of that man. Or perhaps, I say, a single incredible one. Stupendous sex is a drug, addictive, consuming. I know from personal experience. Sounds like you have someone in mind. I'm so not in the mood, Mac. He'd only pale in comparison. Maybe not. I lean across the counter and speak softly into her ear. When she leaves, wearing a thoughtful expression, I ponder the seed I planted, hoping it yields healthy fruit. I think it will. I think it's exactly what she needs to buffer her heart, cleanse her body from craving the touch of a man we both know she can never hold. Besides, there's a possibility it will piss Riordan off, in a territorial sort of way, which will still further ease the sting to Joe's wounded heart. Heaven knows the man I pointed her at won't mind. I smile and line a few choice bottles up on my counter and try my hand at pouring high and flashy. Patrons love a good show. When I glance up to greet a couple of new customers, I inhale sharply and stare right past them, staggered by the vision I see, unable to process my abrupt change in fortune. Talk about tall, dark, and utterly unexpected. Time grinds to a halt, and everything goes still around me, the thronging patrons receding beyond the edges of my periphery, leaving only one. The dreamy-eyed guy, wearing an amused expression, is standing three clubs away, watching me toss my bottles flamboyantly, and I recall a night I watched him do the same. He inclines his head, dark eyes starry.
Nice show.
The unseelie king is back in town, wearing his old skins again. We've been scouring ancient books and scrolls for months, trying to find the spell to summon him, and the surgeon I need just arrived out of the blue. The one with butterfly fingers who creates and destroys worlds, and can surely remove this great staining darkness inside me. I didn't think he'd ever come back willingly. Off with his concubine somewhere, rekindling her memory and reclaiming her love. Elation floods me. I can get my life back, and while I'm at it, get rid of my smelly unseelie, too. Approach the queen about the song of... I swiftly terminate that thought and repadlock it. I vault the counter, sending glasses flying and shoving startled patrons off their stools. But by the time my feet hit the floor, the dreamy-eyed guy is gone. 18. When life pushes me, I push harder. What doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Mac. The next few days pass in the closest thing to hopeful peace I've known in months. Even surrounded by the debauchery of Chester's, my inner book remains silent. I don't know if seeing the king made it shut up for some reason, if familiar routine makes me that much stronger, or if it thinks it has me trapped in the cesspool of life here at Chester's, and my capitulation is only a matter of time. I tend bar amid my unseelie coven, watch for the various forms of the king, keep an eye out for princesses, and await Baron's return, hopefully with Danny in tow. I can't wait to tell him the king is back and we can quit losing time in the Silvers. When the ruler of the Dark Fae took an interest in Dublin before, his various incarnations often came to the club. The unseelie king is too vast to walk among humans in a single human body. He has to divide himself into multiple skins, and when he does, not everyone sees him the same way. Where I saw a young, hot guy with gorgeous eyes, Baron saw a frail old man. Christian saw a Morgan Freeman look-alike. Joe saw a pretty French woman. It's only a matter of time before we see one of them again. Or I hear of a McCabe sighting or run into the old news vendor on the streets. I'll be faster next time, because I won't be struck dumb and motionless by his unexpected return. The thought of living divided like this, tempted every day by power I can't use, tortured by thoughts of what my inner monster might be able to make me do if I'm not vigilant 100% of the time, is more than I can stand. Can't eviscerate essential self, the king once said. But this copy of the book isn't my essential self, it's his. And I'll be damned if I'm keeping it. At least now I can stop considering a risky plan B. The king came to Dublin once before because his book escaped. It seems logical if Cruce escaped, the king would return and re-ice him, and I could demand he free me. Unfortunately, I'm not entirely convinced the king would A. return, or B. give a shit about any of it. His priorities spring of stars and infinity, not the tiny moments that span a human life. And there we'd be, with Cruce loose. Dicey plan. Humming beneath my breath, I finish polishing my bar. It's 11 in the morning, and I've just opened my sub-club for business. The glasses sparkle, so clean they squeak. Ice is stocked, glasses frosted, condiments fresh, liquor replenished. I'm bent over, reaching in the fridge to pull out lemons and start making my twists, when I hear a deep baritone say,
"Lafroig, no ice."
The accent is Scottish, the voice one I've heard before. I glance up into eyes strikingly similar to Christian's, before he began turning unseelie. They bore into mine, cheetah gold, assessing. Same 5 o'clock shadow, chiseled features and beautiful dark skin. Serious power rolls off the man. It's Christian's uncle, the Keltar they call the Inhabited. He once opened himself up to 13 ancient dark druids and has never been able to exorcise them. I can sympathize with that problem. The last time I saw him was the night we interred the Shisadu beneath the abbey. He was with his twin brother, Drustan, a druid who died in a fire but somehow came back to life and allegedly possesses an incorruptible heart. Another of Christian's uncles, Keon, who spent 1,000 years trapped in the Silver, and Christian's father, who was also druid to the Seelie. Talk about your messed up family. Dagus, right?
Aye.
He palms the glass I slide him and takes a sip.
What's with all the unseelie behind the bar with you, lads?
Another question I'm sick of. I get it 100 times a day, at least once from every person that takes a stool and orders a drink. And as the day goes on, 6 times from the really drunk ones. I've heard every variation on every joke they could possibly slap lamely together in their inebriated, sex-obsessed minds. Ghosts, I say, of all the unseelie I killed, they haunt me. I found it usually shuts people up. He doesn't look at all surprised, but then why would he? His ghosts haunt him from the inside.
Where is the bastard that runs this club?
Around somewhere. Are you here because you've located Christian? I ask hopefully.
Nay. We've tried summoning the Queen repeatedly to request our aid, but she's not responding to any of our rituals.
I wonder if buried in their countless records and annals, they have a summoning spell for the King. Although I don't appear to currently need it, I file the thought away for future reference, aware that asking such a question might only open a new can of worms and turn more pairs of intensely penetrating Keltar eyes my way than I'd like.
Now that the compact is broken, with no influence over the Fey world, Christian's gone, without trace. The only thing of which we're certain is he's not in Ireland anymore. We've fair torn the country apart searching.
Can't you try tracking the Crimson Hag instead?
We've naught of her to use in such a spell. We'd need flesh, bone, a gut from her gown might serve.
No recent sightings?
The Unseelie princes claim she tried to capture them shortly after she took Christian, but they've since joined forces, and she's not been seen again.
He rubs a stubble-shadowed jaw.
It happened differently than I foresaw,
he says heavily.
I was watching for the wrong signs.
I'm about to ask what he's talking about when Riordan takes a stool beside him.
Keltar, here you're looking for me.
Translation? He was sitting upstairs in his office, watching his endless cameras, eavesdropping. I'm surprised he came down. Appears he has enough respect for the Highlander to do more than he does for most. Acknowledge his presence and appear as requested. Huh, interesting. Dagus says just as coolly.
Here you met with a Seely prince, had negotiations. You will be summoning him for us now.
Riordan cuts him an amused look.
Will I? Think again.
What do you want with Rajan? I asked Dagus.
He's a sifter, and is currently in control of all Seely. I want him to dispatch other sifters down the Hag for us.
Couldn't you send some of your men as well? I say to Riordan quickly. If Christian hadn't distracted the Hag and she'd kept killing that night, who knows what might have happened? We owe him, Riordan. All of us. We can't just leave him out there being killed over and over again.
It's keeping her busy and out of my fucking hair,
Riordan says. I should have known better than to try an emotional entreaty with him. I employ reason in my next attempt. If we don't save him from the Hag, he'll be more problematic to you, to all of us, should he eventually escape. He was sane enough to sacrifice himself. That sanity won't last long in her hands. Riordan shrugs.
We put him down if he returns. No different than any other Unseelie prince. If he's not useful, he's disposable.
No other Unseelie prince would have sacrificed himself, I snap.
He is Keltar, and that is all the difference necessary,
Dagus says.
In exchange for your aid, we'll help you reclaim the Abbey from those who've taken over.
He drops the bomb quietly. What? I practically shout. Someone has taken over the Abbey? I look at Riordan and my hands curl into fists. He knew and said nothing to me. When did you find out about this? I demand. And why didn't you tell me? You do remember what's under there, right?
I'll handle it when the others return. And don't say that again in here.
I grit my jaw. I can't believe I just said it. Here of all places. No, I didn't spell out what was beneath the Abbey, but I said enough that a curious eavesdropper might decide to go looking. Dagus says,
Three have already met their deaths. No doubt more will be finding graves the longer you delay.
Not if I have anything to say about it, and I could write a dissertation. I strip the apron from my waist and begin closing my bar down. I shiver, dreading the answer to my next question. All good coups begin with the deposing of the current leader. Is Kat okay?
I'm sure she is. She's a survivor,
Riordan says. I glare at him. He's never said anything that nice about me. Dagus finishes his drink and slides it back for another.
I don't ken the names of the slain. During battle for possession of the grounds, the Sheseer escaped. We found her stumbling, badly injured, along the road toward Dublin. Thruston took her to the hospital at Dublin Castle. Your Inspector Jane said he will commit the aid of his guardians, but only if the Sheseers turn over either the spear or sword to his troops. Permanently.
I slap lids on the condiments and shove them in the fridge. Not a chance in hell. What happened, Riordan? You were supposed to place more powerful wards around the grounds. That was part of our negotiations.
My men have been busy, in case you've forgotten. Besides, you asked us to place more wards against Fae, not humans.
Humans took control? This just keeps getting worse. Who?
The new Sheseers say it's their home now.
I narrow my eyes and snarl. Sheseers came into our town and took our home? I promised Kat we wouldn't let this happen. I promised her we would protect the Abbey. We're the home team. Nobody takes our stadium. How many are there? What weapons do they have? How did they take the Abbey? Didn't Kat put up a fight? Dagus says,
if your Kat, who was with us that night, is in charge now, that may explain things. The woman we found said their headmistress has been missing for nigh a week, and someone inside their own group, Marjorie, invited the new Sheseers in.
Nearly a week? That means she disappeared the day after our meeting. Have you seen her? I ask Riordan.
What do you think? She comes to visit me?
He says.
This is Katerina we're talking about.
Bar's closed. I snap at a guy about to sit down. He looks at Riordan and Dagus.
They're sitting here.
I said it's closed.
Pour me a drink, bitch. It's a free fucking world.
He drops a leg over the stool. Riordan smashes a fist out sideways, squarely into the guy's face without even looking, while saying,
assuming I arrange this meeting, the Keltar will aid in regaining control of the Abbey regardless of the outcome.
The guy flies backward off the barstool and crashes to the floor.
Unlike you, we are men of our word. Unlike you,
Dagus growls,
we are men, as in human. Humans break.
Riordan doesn't say it. Doesn't have to. It hangs in the air. We don't. The guy Riordan punched picks himself up, gives us looks like we're all crazy, and backs away into the crowd. I tell Dagus, the meeting with Rajan happens after we free the Abbey.
It happens before, or not at all,
Dagus says flatly. More Sheseers could die, I say heatedly.
Aye, once. Christian is being butchered o'er and o'er again every day.
The Highlander's brogue thickens.
Who kens it? Perhaps he's died 100 times so far. Have you any idea what that can do to a man?
I shiver. Yes. It sounds too similar to the hell Baron's son suffered. Regenerating only to be killed each time he was reborn. It turned the small boy into an animal, drove the child deep into madness from which there was no return. What is the same fate doing to Christian, even as we speak, who was highly unstable to begin with? He certainly hasn't had an easy time of it since I arrived in Dublin, catapulted unarmed into the Silvers for years by a botched ritual, fed unseelie by myself, locked in a desperate battle for control over what he's becoming, and now held captive by a monster that rips out his guts every time he heals.
His mind is fragile. His body is not. 'Tis a dangerous and deadly imbalance that can go terribly wrong.
It certainly is. To Riordan, I say, summon the prince for Dagus, or I'm moving back to the bookstore and leaving you on your own with the Unseelie princesses. With barons in Faerie, you're the only one I'm protecting anyway. To Dagus, I say, get your clan ready to fight.
Och, Michaela, 'tis not a thing for which the Kelter need preparing. We were born ready. 19. Hey, hey, mama, like the way you move. Lore. Think you missed the spot?
I tell the voluptuous blonde that's washing my dick. I'm pariah, I can't be expected to bathe myself. They've been giving me sponge baths because I'm pretty much covered from head to toe in pussy juice. They feed me and fuck me and clean me. Reminds me of the good old days when a man protected women with his club and they took care of him in return. This week has been one of the finest of my existence. Well, at least in the past century, anyway. A veritable fuck party 24/7, with 5 to 10 women in the room at any given time. Their sole reason for existing to sate my many needs. All blonde, all buxom, all horny as hell. Life rocks. It's better than Woodstock. At first, I pretended to be completely senseless, incapable of speech, but that gets old fast. Can't tell a woman what you want next if you're not talking. Can't ask what they want, although I never have a problem figuring that out. You watch their faces, listen to the sounds they make. Do they whimper, or do that sudden inhale that turns into a killer husky purr? Do they growl and turn a good fuck into a better fight? Most women in these times got a whole lot of frustration to take out in bed when they know they got a man big and tough enough to handle it. Are they the kind that tries not to make any sound at all, like they're too tough to crack? That's just waving a big-ass red flag at this bull. Those are the ones that always end up making the most noise by the time I'm done with them. I especially like the ones that hiss like a cat when I fuck them hard from behind, rubbing back, horny and passionate and wild. Damn, I love women. One thing that seems universal is that after a good hard fucking, most of them love to lay back and have a man take his time with them, stroking them from head to toe, licking, petting, telling them how beautiful they are, making them come over and over, especially with their hands tied. Not that I'm into your run-of-the-mill S&M. I like to know the woman in my bed wants to call me master. That being said, I do like chains. Something about the heavy links against soft silken skin, telling me I can take my time doing whatever I want. Test their sexual limits. There's another sticky spot. I point to my groin where a smear of honey lingers. She licks it off with cat-like delicacy, then starts sucking. Christ. Once I realized the boss had fallen for my charade and wasn't checking on me, I quit being so disgustingly pariah. According to the promise I made Mac, I got one more week of this, then it's back to the grind. I mean to make the most of it. Then I'll hunt and kill the unseelie bitch that has some kind of strange magic that actually worked on me. Turn me pariah? You can't amp up my sex drive. It's already over the top. Oh, fuck me. This blonde's got a tongue that could strip copper tubing clean. I grab her head and pull her up to kiss the honey from her mouth. As I roll her beneath me, crushed between a tangle of naked horny women and about to drive in deep, I hear a woman say sternly,
"Get out of here, all of you."
What the fuck? I didn't even hear the door open. Has the boss figured me out? Did Mac rat on me? I ignore it. They're gonna have to drag me out of this bed.
You know I'm Riordan's girlfriend. You know he listens to me. You want to keep your jobs?
I freeze, halfway in. It's Joe. What the hell is she doing here? Reluctantly, with a pissed-off sound, the woman in my arms tries to disengage. I groan and hold on, won't let her go.
In 5 seconds, anyone that's still in bed with Lore is fired.
In 2 seconds, my bed is empty. None of these women are willing to lose such a highly valued commodity as a place to work, food, and shelter, not in times like these. Not even for the glory of my dick. I sigh, then turn it into another weird-ass moan. I don't moan, I fucking roar. This pariah business is taxing. I roll onto my side and give Joe my ass, hoping she'll just say whatever she has to say and go away, send back my babes. I try to summon a pathetic whimper, but it comes out sounding too much like me, a pissed-off, sexually frustrated grunt. My dick was ready, almost home sweet home, and now it's been relegated to a cardboard box beneath a bridge, cold and alone. It's swollen and painfully compressed between the bed and my thigh. I'm supposed to be a sex slave, so I can hardly roll over and ask her what the fuck she's doing here. I hear a rustling sound, then feel her weight settle on the bed next to me. Then there's the sound of a washcloth drizzling water as she wrings it out into the basin, and I think, what the hell? Joe's gonna finish the bath the blondes were giving me. When she settles a hand on my back, I jerk. This is Joe. This is Riordan's territory. I don't mess with the boss's stuff. Nobody does. It'd be nearly as stupid as pissing off barons.
Mac told me you're prior,
Joe says.
She says she doesn't remember anything from that time, that it's all just a blur of sex.
I'm instantly defensive. She looking to cheat on the boss? Women don't cheat on Riordan. Fuck, they don't cheat on any of us. You don't give up the best. She runs her hand over my back, down my ass. I tense, but stay perfectly still, thinking.
God, you're beautiful,
she says softly. Wait, I'm supposed to moan. I try, but get another frustrated grunt. Shit.
I need a blur of sex,
she continues, talking and touching. Who doesn't? My dick gets harder. She's not even my type. She's petite and brunette with huge eyes and a delicate face. She's exactly what I steer clear of. But I'm supposedly prior. I sigh. Looks like my game is ending sooner than I planned. I grunt with sheer frustration and roll over. Look up at her to tell her to get her ass back to the boss and we'll just forget all about this. My dick snaps straight up, pointing to heaven, expressing firm opposition. I clamp my open mouth shut again, thinking, oh, no, 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 don't do that, honey, anything but that. She's staring down at me with big, beautiful eyes filled with tears.
You're not really there, right?
She searches my face, and I instantly make my eyes go glassy. I've been doing it for days. It's second nature now. She looks down at my dick, and I try to will it limp, but it doesn't work for shit. It's a simple beast. A woman is an occasion. My dick rises to it.
I couldn't stand it if I thought you'd remember this. It's just that I broke up with Riordan.
Ah, shit.
Not that you can really even call it a breakup, because I knew from the beginning we weren't really together.
Sometimes the boss really pisses me off. We never keep a woman more than a few weeks. Human women fall in love. It's just what they do. So you gotta be real clear from the get-go that things aren't permanent. And Riordan did stupid things, like sometimes putting his arm around her. And the fact is, I knew all along he was just doing it to keep better tabs on Danny, because we'd pretty much all do anything to watch over that kid. We've been watching her for years, keeping her alive, giving her the chance to grow up. It ain't been easy. The kid's a handful, and we all kind of wonder what kind of woman she's gonna be one day. Can't help it. When you live as long as we do, you find yourself in bed with women you watched get born. It's weird, and not at the same time. I know we gotta protect our own, by any means necessary. But when you're as addictive as we are, you gotta be careful who you let in the candy store, and how far. And there's some candy you just don't put on the shelves. Not with humans.
I knew all along he was just keeping an eye on Danny and the Abbey.
She surprises me by saying,
at first I was doing the same. Watching your back. Trying to divine your secrets. Decide if you were friend or foe. At least that's what I told myself. Cat wanted someone on the inside at Chester's. And it made me feel special that she'd asked me. That he wanted me in his bed. I thought about it for all of 1 minute. There was no way I was going to pass up that kind of chance. Great sex on top of spying. I felt like a female James Bond.
She gives a soft, sad laugh that ends on a sob.
I didn't get a sheer talent like the others. I don't have a superpower. Just this damn sticky memory that doesn't even work because I imprint everything I see and end up with so much useless detritus in my head that I can never find anything useful. I have the meaning of every word stored up there, but I don't know the filing system.
Who am I?
Joe, the busy researcher. Want a fact? I can't remember where to find it in my mind, but I can recall where I saw it well enough to know where to look.
She flicks herself lightly in the forehead with a finger.
I don't understand the point of my gift. It's useless. Everyone else is out saving the world, while I hole up with books and hunt for answers. I wanted to feel extraordinary, like I was doing something for a change. I didn't realize how hard it would be to go back to ordinary. Nothing changed at all. I just got hurt.
She starts crying harder, and I'm fucking horrified. I can't stand tears. Not from a woman. I only know one thing to do. Kiss them away. She's not my type. She places her small hands on my face and bends over me, her mouth a few inches away.
Erase him for me, Lore. Make me forget him. Take the taste of him out of my mouth. Fill it up with you. You'll never remember that you helped me forget. Please, Lore, make love to me.
Ah, I fucking hate that phrase. I don't make love, I fuck. That's it, plain and simple. Fuck. Clearly defined, no strings attached, as in rut and grunt and get my rocks off. I'm the caveman. I'm the sexual barbarian. I open my mouth to tell her that, but all of a sudden she pulls back from me and yanks her shirt off over her head. And these positively fucking perfect small breasts pop out. Don't know the last time I saw little tits. I forgot what they looked like. I stare and feel my eyes going glassy all on their own. Tiny waist, creamy skin flushed with embarrassment and desire, and pretty pink nipples that... Ah, shit, here I go. Damn, nipples, they get me every time.
Lord, please.
She says, hot tears falling like rain on my skin.
Make love to me. Make me forget.
Slow and sweet, she bends over me and traces my lips with her tongue, breath warm, smelling faintly of peppermint. I don't do this kind of woman. Never this kind of woman. And sure as fuck not the way she wants it. Next thing I know, I'm hiking that sweet short skirt up over her sweet round ass, breaking my own rules, gonna screw a brunette on the highway to hell.
20. Mama, I'm coming home. Mac. Situated on 1,000 acres of prime farmland about 2 hours from Dublin, Arlington Abbey is a self-sustaining fortress, with multiple artesian wells, a dairy, beef cattle, orchard, and acres of vegetable gardens. Whether Rowena performed powerful spells to protect it, or the Shades simply chose to go in another direction when they decamped the city en masse a few months ago, about 30 minutes from the ancient mother house, the countryside was left untouched by their voracious appetites. It's difficult to believe I haven't been out this way since mid-May, the night we sealed the Shisadu in the vast, heavily ruined underground chamber beneath the fortress. Time flies, especially when you keep losing it inside the Silvers. After we defeated the Shisadu, Barons and I retreated to his lair beneath the garage, leaving bed only when near starvation forced us out. A few days later, we laid his son to rest, finally freeing the father from a small eternity of torment, and began discussing plans to return to the mother house and take further measures to protect the world from the great winged prince beneath the abbey that has stood as a prison, in one form or another, in the middle of a grassy Irish field, since the unlucky day the king selected our planet for that purpose. I'd proposed pumping the chamber full of concrete the very night the king iced Cruz. Barons later argued for removing the prince, intact in his prison of ice, and transporting the chamber into the Hall of All Days to dump on some other unsuspecting world. We did neither. Obsessed with my quest to rid the world of the other book, the next thing I knew we were stepping from the Silver behind the bookstore into a city so heavily iced it was nearly impassable. Our new enemy wasn't one that could be physically battled.
Not that I was currently effective in that department anyway. Getting involved would have turned too many eyes my way, raised questions about my stalkers, and put me in closer proximity to Danny than I was ready for. It was the hardest thing I've ever done to trust that others would handle the problem while I attempted to handle my own. I stare out the window, watching the scenery whiz by. What the shades didn't devour, the Hoarfrost King decimated. But spring has begun transforming the ice-ravaged landscape, pushing buds from skeletal limbs, and a thin carpet of grass shimmers in the moonlight. After the violent killing frost, it may be years before the Emerald Isle regains its legendary green. I sprawl in the passenger seat in the Humvee, one booted foot on the dash. Riordan refused to let me drive, no surprise there. We're both control freaks. Bracing myself for the upcoming battle. My dark flock is hitching a ride on the roof. I ponder the upcoming confrontation like a poker game I'm about to enter, and the various ways the cards might play out. The metaphor is appropriate, given bluffing appears to be my strongest suit. I love a good battle, especially on the right side, and we are. The Abbey belongs to us. Assuming I go inside, what cards can I safely allow myself to play? My spear is useless. I've been mulling over the two times my flock ascended to the rooftops, and I drew my spear. The first against Danny, the second against the Grey Woman, trying to decide what pushed me over the edge the second time and gave the book the leverage it needed. Until I can isolate the precise moment I lost control, the how and why, I'm not using my spear again. I left my guns at the bookstore, but have a switchblade in each boot. I won't use those either. Violence is the door the book kicks through, sticks in a foot and wedges open. Barons keeps the amulet locked in a vault beneath the garage. I wouldn't touch it anyway. We decided months ago that it was too risky to attempt to fool it twice the same way. Besides, I've thought of it so many times, I'm not certain it's not an idea the book keeps planning. Nearly all my mental terrain is suspect to me. On days when it hasn't stirred much, I get worried.
You can't seek a weapon to use against it. You must become that weapon.
Barons has said over and over. I know voice. I'm good at it, too. There's a useful tool. If we get into a heated battle, I can keep a circle clear around me merely by barking orders. I get a mental picture of myself, standing unarmed and passive in the middle of a raging battle, shouting, "Stay away from me! Don't touch me! Drop your weapon!" I blow out a frustrated breath. I can null, but that's only effective on Fae. Present ghoulish company excluded. I'm good in hand-to-hand combat, assuming I don't black out. My cards in this poker game suck. I need a redeal, or at least a few wild cards. I'm itching to meet the supposedly legendary She-Seer leader, stand in front of her and take her measure. I wonder about the women she commands, what their talents are, whether one of them might be like me, able to sense the She-Seer. I try to assure myself the likelihood is slim. But if the Unseelie King really did make us to serve as prison guards for his dark disaster, it seems logical he'd also have made more like me, in case it ever got out. I heave a conflicted sigh and decide I'm being paranoid. The She-Seers told me no one in their entire history at the Abbey was ever able to sense the book like Alina and me. None of them are nulls, and considering we come from the mother house in the originating homeland, where it was interred by the king himself, I sincerely doubt the away teams were likewise gifted. In fact, they're probably deluded from millennia of living in far-off lands, divorced from their heritage. Good military fighters, but little more.
Christ, stop sighing. You'll blow us off the fucking road. Something you want to talk about, Mac?
I look over at Riordan, inscrutable as ever in the dim light from the dashboard. I doubt my threat to quit protecting him was motivation. Riordan pursues his own agenda. Why did you agree to help free the Abbey? You never do anything unless there's something in it for you.
I want their new leader off the streets. She and her followers are killing Fae. Bad for business.
What are you going to do with her? Kill her? I don't like that thought. Though I, too, intend to see her deposed, I want her neutralized, not dead. There's been too much death in Dublin.
Perhaps she can be recalibrated into a useful weapon. If not, then yes.
What happened when you and Dagus met with Rajan? Dagus had insisted on privacy for the meeting in Riordan's office. I'd loitered outside, wishing I still had his cell phone with the handy eavesdropping skull and crossbones app. Did he agree to send an army to hunt the hag?
In exchange for an additional seat at our table.
Who? There are no other princes. I wonder about that. Where are the replacements? Are they trapped somewhere? Like Christian was in the Unseelie prison, becoming? Did eating Unseelie really hasten his transformation?
An advisor whose vote will tie his with those of the Unseelie.
And you allowed it? He says nothing, but I don't need him to. Of course he did. The Unseelie and Seelie will always vote against each other out of sheer stupid principle, canceling each other out, giving you the permanent upper hand.